Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 5th, 2019. This class is class 13 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This talk is on the Sika Sutta and the importance of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Today's class is 13 of 32, I think, of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into the three marks of existence, and specifically into anatta, an understanding of the Buddha's meaning of self and not self. I mean, as all of the suttas in this series, and really all of the Buddha's Dhamma, it resolves within the individual. In other words, there's nothing external that we can acquire, and there's nothing external that acts on us in order to awaken. And this sutta speaks specifically to that, and it describes the only path the Buddha taught and the only meditation method the Buddha taught. And he also teaches why. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's called the Sika Sutta. The Buddha addressed those gathered. Friends, there are three trainings that I teach. I teach training in heightened virtue, I teach training in heightened concentration, and I teach training in heightened wisdom. Those three trainings are incorporated in the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is often characterized as just that. It's a path of heightened virtue, heightened wisdom, and heightened concentration. And so even the explanation points to the skills that we're hoping to develop through this Eightfold Path. The training in heightened virtue brings restraint in speech, actions, and livelihood. So an individual can only practice restraint. I guess you could say if you're imprisoned or locked up or anything like that or tied down. But it's up to us to restrain ourselves. In other words, a belief system, following someone or having someone tell you how to act and just doing it blindly does not bring virtue. That's just following something that may or may not be rooted in ignorance. We do this ourselves. We've talked about this a lot lately, and there's a whole series of talks that we've given on the wisdom of restraint. But this is the key point of the Dhamma. It's as we're interfacing with life, as we're interacting with life, as we're encountering life, as we're contacting life, that is the point that we practice the Dhamma. That's the point that we practice restraint. We had a great conversation on this. I think it was last Saturday, wasn't it? About using that word restraint and how ego personality doesn't like that word at all. But that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to recognize and abandon how something has arisen out of ignorance, to recognize it and abandon it. It takes restraint. The training in heightened virtue brings restraint in speech, actions, and livelihood. This Dhamma practitioner remains pure in their behavior at all times. They train themselves following the rules of behavior and understand the danger of even the slightest deviation. That's such an important line there. The danger and even the slightest deviation. The danger to who? The danger to me and my path to awakening. Because if I'm not willing to take restraint to its ultimate conclusion, in other words, if I make excuses for a few things that I like to hang on to, chocolate cake, for instance, or something else, that's a silly example. Ultimately, that resolves in views that I'm hanging on to that I refuse to let go of. And these, when we decide that we have individually developed certain virtuous views, and they're virtuous simply because I think they are, I'm in trouble. Because I'm going to cling to those views because they're right views, except they're wrong views because they're rooted in ignorance. And ultimately, the Dhamma resolves those issues of clinging to fabricated views. No matter how compassionate or virtuous they may seem, if they're arising from ignorance, there's danger in that. There's an even the slightest deviation of making excuses for things that don't fall within the framework of the Eightfold Path means that we're simply not going to get there. And it's just that way. It's not It's not it's not even so much as a moral issue, although it's outwardly reflected in morality and ethics. It's an internal problem that we're dealing with. In other words, it doesn't take... When I develop the Dhamma, I no longer need the world and my interactions with the world to verify whether I'm being a good human being, whether I'm being compassionate or honest or loving, or maybe even justifiably hateful towards something because everybody else does. It shows me how to look at that myself. It shows me how to disentangle myself from my associations that may only reaffirm hurtful beliefs, even though those beliefs outwardly may seem humanistic and societally, is a good word, important. It's the underlying intention that's most important. And a good example would be all the difficulties caused by sincere but misguided religious folk, going back to the Christian crusades in modern days now with jihad and all those things, justified because my God tells me to do this and everybody else and my associates are doing it. To that mind, it seems like the most righteous thing to do. Of course, it's really in ignorance, isn't it? The same person might be motivated to be helpful to everyone, but if it's rooted in wisdom, that person can then be truly helpful without causing harm to the general population. Is that clear? It's kind of a subtle difference until we realize it, and then it's very stark, the difference between compassion rooted in ignorance and compassion rooted in wisdom. It looks the same, but the results are always different. This is called training in heightened virtue. The training in heightened concentration, jhana, develops the concentration necessary to support refined mindfulness. It's also a comment on today's the catch-all modern religion of mindfulness, which is often taught that you just mindfulness, this practice of mindfulness simply means to be mindful of what's occurring. That's true, but a mind that is lacking concentration can't really do that. They can only fool themselves by jumping from object to object to object and say, oh yeah, I'm mindful of this, I'm mindful of that, I'm mindful of washing dishes. There's even a rather famous book that talks about mindfulness applied to washing dishes. I think it's... And I read the book, and it's very well written, and it's also very distracting, because it leads one to believe that as long as I can be mindful of when I'm washing the dishes, that I'm developing some type of useful practice. You're not. There needs to be some concentration under that, underlying that, and supporting that mindfulness. And then mindfulness, as the Buddha teaches, is not to be mindful of dishes and washing the dishes. It's mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. And as we integrate the Eightfold Path, we're simply mindful of everything we're doing. We don't have to objectify anything as, oh, I'm going to be mindful of this. It's a natural expression of who we are that we develop. To support refined mindfulness, this Dhamma practitioner remains secluded from sensory indulgence and unskillful qualities. It's another important line. Secluded begins with our meditation practice and how we actually do that, meaning that we remove ourselves from the world, we find a quiet, secluded place, and we do jhana. It's how the Buddha always taught or always told people it's time to go meditate and what to do. Go find the root of a tree or an empty hut and do jhana. That's how the Buddha described every meditation method. Every meditation session. He never taught anything else other than a jhana practice. And the reason why I'm saying that is we've created all these different hybrid activities that we call meditation when they're not. And the best example, the most misapplied example, is something called walking meditation. It's good to be mindful when we're walking, just as it's good to be mindful when we're washing dishes. But it's not a meditation practice. It can be an outcropping or a function of a well-concentrated mind. But meditation is a practice that is rooted in seclusion. Why? Because as we establish that seclusion in our meditation practice, rooted in concentration, we're able to get up off our cushions, go out into the world, and remain secluded from the world while we're involved in the world. Lorna brought this up not that long ago about how you recognize that, mm-hmm. that your seclusion isn't just on your cushion. A well-developed Dhamma practice means that you stay secluded 100% of the time, no matter what type of activity you're involved in. everybody clear on that? So seclusion is developed on our cushion, and then it's enhanced and developed further through the Eightfold Path. And so while we're out in the world, now we can take that seclusion, that concentration, that peace of mind off our cushion, remain secluded or disentangled from the world, and yet be a vital part of that world, be meaningfully engaged in the world in a way that was never before possible, because now we are well concentrated and mindful of what's occurring.
Isn't that, you just said it's seclusion from the world, but isn't it also seclusion from your thoughts? From
yes,
that constant monkey mind thoughts.
Absolutely.
It's also that seclusion.
Yeah, in fact, that's the ultimate seclusion, and it's that seclusion that allows us to be in the world and not entangled in it. And so we are literally secluding ourselves from unskillful thoughts rooted in ignorance. It's a well-secluded person in a well-secluded mind. There's an aspect of restraint in seclusion, isn't there? It's all part of this wonderful and gentle path that leads us from deep clinging and craving entanglements in the world to that very same human being living in the world with a peaceful and calm mind, no matter what's occurring. It's the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma.
It's also the exercise of creating a new conditioned mind. It's giving you the concentration so you can be secluded. So there's you're retraining your mind. So you
yes.
have that monkey mind, even though you're not free from all thoughts, but you come back to the breath, and then you take that off the cushion, and your mind's conditioned.
Yeah. We're not entangled with our own thoughts anymore. Mm-hmm. Our thoughts no longer drive us. We drive our thoughts, like the Buddha said in many suttas, but I always come back to Vitakka Santana Sutta. We gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, meaning whatever is appropriate to be thinking about in relation to the world is framed by the Eightfold Path, and it's completely appropriate. And so often, the especially people that are first coming to grips with what is implied in this, it seems like annihilation, doesn't it? But that's only because we're secluding ourselves from wrong views, from everything that seems familiar and comfortable with us, excuse me. But that familiarity is rooted in a wrong view of self, anatta. And so it always will lead to stress. It will always lead to disappointment. Thank you, David. This Dhamma practitioner remains secluded from sensory indulgence and unskillful mental qualities. That's what we're remaining secluded from ultimately. It's not a physical seclusion, from sensory indulgence and unskillful mental qualities. They enter and remain in the first jhana, characterized by rapture and pleasure born of seclusion and accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. So we begin our meditation practice. Everybody does this. We enter in the first jhana intentionally. We seclude ourselves physically. We find a comfortable spot, close our eyes. We become mindful of the breath and the body. And that rapture, it's a rather archaic term, and often it has an association with the second coming. Rapture simply means here a joyful, well-focused engagement in the Dhamma. We're happy about what we're doing. And as we enter that first jhana, there is still directed thought, isn't there? And part of that directed thought is directing us back to the breath when we find ourselves caught up in our thoughts again. And at that first beginning aspect of meditation, there's also evaluation or replacing a value on our performance and our meditation practice. And I don't think anybody can escape that. We can't help to do it. Am I doing this right? Am I getting the benefits? Am I following that crazy old bald guy the way he says we should? All of that stuff. Do I need to think about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path while I'm meditating? All these things that come up, those are all part of what is called evaluation, what we're referring to as evaluation. We're valuing, we're placing a value judgment on whether we're doing this right or wrong. What do we do with that when we find ourselves caught up in evaluation? We go to the second jhana. We don't do anything with it. Continue to meditate. Characterize the first jhana as characterized by rapture and pleasure born of seclusion and accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the second jhana. Focus thoughts and insight still, such an important line. We're not using meditation, jhana meditation, for insight. That's part of directed thought, isn't it? And it's one of the big problems with, I always get myself in trouble when I say these things, it's one of the big problems with the modern Vipassana movement, because that the way that's presented, it's the meditation method is directed towards constant insight. And so there's no concentration developed. There were very little. I'm not putting it down. It's just different. I'm saying that because people yell at me sometimes. It's unpleasant emails.
You keep saying it. They keep yelling.
They keep yelling. I guess I should have. Anyway, thoughts and insights still. That's that. And we all experience this, don't we? As we deepen our concentration in our meditation practice, our thoughts still. It doesn't mean that they stay stilled. And it doesn't mean that we stop chasing insight. It means in that moment, my thoughts have stilled. Uh-oh, there it is again. What do I do? Come back to the sensation of breathing. But we are now in the second jhana. We've done quite a series of talks on jhana because it's so important. There's such a misunderstanding of even the reference to the four levels of jhana, the four levels of meditative absorption. They're often, in fact, almost exclusively taught that even the first jhana, even to consider doing jhana, is something for a super advanced meditator who has probably been meditating for a million lifetimes. And it's just not true. This is the Buddha used the word jhana and the word meditative absorption to simply describe the four levels of meditative absorption that each and every meditation practitioner who's doing jhana meditation develops. There's nothing extraordinary about this. And he taught this Not so much as we're setting up a goal to get through these jhanas, but simply so that we understand that meditation is working. We're actually doing this. We're actually developing this. They're not something to grasp after. Thoughts and insights still. Delight and pleasure born of composure and inner assurance arise. We've all had that experience, haven't you? During meditation, and it might just be briefly, that your thoughts have stilled, this calm composure arises within you, and you have this inner self-assurance. Yes? Mm-hmm. Has anybody not experienced that? That's the second jhana. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the third jhana. Excuse me. Delight and pleasure and the perception of pleasure and pain disappear. Delight and pleasure and the perception of pleasure and pain disappear. And again, the Buddha's not saying, he's not describing a permanent state in the beginning of meditation, but we've all had that experience, haven't we? At least for the moment, we're no longer concerned with, am I feeling good? Am I feeling bad? You know, am I going to feel good? Am I going to feel bad? We're just simply present with life as unfolding in that moment. And a thought arises again. We come back to the sensation of breathing. And we're deepening concentration. One of the things that when I first started looking at this, and this was after years of conditioning of hearing the word jhana as something that was extraordinary and way beyond any human means, especially me. When I first started understanding what the Buddha is teaching, I realized that I've studied most of the meditation methods that are out there, probably not all because there's an unlimited number. Nothing provided this clarity of what to look for in my experience. Nothing provided this direction. And it was remarkable because it describes the entire Dhamma practice metaphorically, but also practically experience sitting on our cushions.
But it still takes quite a bit of, at least for me, it takes a lot of teasing things apart. In those descriptions to really get the meaning of it.
Yes, it does.
I don't know if it's just because you have your your previous experience in how you used to meditate or how you used to be told to meditate. But it's easy to misunderstand.
It is. Boy, you bring up such a good point. When I finally found jhana meditation, right meditation, I had been meditating for a lot of years, maybe 15, 18 years with all different methods. But most of the methods, even if they were object or mantra based, they were still directing my mind towards nothing other than something objectified. It's hard to mm-hmm. explain that.
Yeah.
But as I started doing jhana meditation, it was very difficult for me, because that was my conditioned thinking, that was my goal of meditation, which is really an aspect of this misunderstanding of emptiness and nothingness, and creating non-physical establishments, speculative establishments for myself. That was a difficulty, to realize that there was something else to do in meditation. It was to be mindful of just this process,
mm-hmm.
and to recognize. But because my mind was conditioned towards not doing that, you know, I put many, many years in different meditation practices that for me were very difficult to put behind. Mm-hmm. I mentioned I first started with jhana meditation, and even after I was doing, I first started with transcendental meditation, and even after I was doing jhana exclusively for quite a few years, I'd still be sitting in meditation. This usually happens when I'm really tired, you know, just really going with my meditation. And all of a sudden, my mantra would pop up in my head. Years and years later, and I wouldn't even know. I mean, I could tell it was, you know, just a few minutes. But even that was an aspect of that conditioning. You know, and I'm back in that mantra.
Wow.
And in that mantra, there was no mantra based meditation. There was no jhana meditation. It's just there and. One's not right and one's not wrong, unless you want to practice with
one. And
you can't do one or the other, or anything else that I found. The Buddha, again, remember the Buddha practiced and mastered all of the modern, all of the current meditation practices of his time, the most advanced so-called meditation practices of his time. He mastered them very quickly and rejected them out of hand as not leading to the goal of understanding. He realized that they weren't deepening his concentration, so let me continue. Equanimity and refined mindfulness increases, and a peaceful mind prevails. So that third jhana, equanimity and refined mindfulness increases. You've all experienced that. Equanimity simply means a calm and peaceful mind that is balanced. It's not here. It's not there. It's not grasping. You don't even have to say that it's non-grasping. It's simply a balanced state of mind. Everybody's experienced that. It's the third jhana. I know you have one.
John, he's not just talking about in meditation, right? He means like in life.
Well,
yes,
and now specifically in meditation, because what we're learning in meditation, we take off our cushions and bring that into life as we integrate the Eightfold Path. So there, the concentration necessary to develop equanimity 24/7, no matter what we're doing, is rooted in a concentration practice. That's the important teaching here. It's a great question too. Thank you. Equanimity and refined mindfulness increases, and peaceful mind prevails. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Mindful equanimity prevails. Greed and aversion disappear. This is a development of concentration that brings peace and calm here and now. In some of the teachings on jhana specifically, there's a little bit more detail in it. But it really does boil down to this deepening level of concentration from the third to the fourth jhana, and the establishment of equanimity in that mind. And as Julia just pointed out, and once we have experienced it, at this point, everything that Buddha taught, he taught must be experienced, or it's not useful knowledge. In other words, there's nothing abstract about this. The way we learn, the way human beings learn, is we first are taught something that is abstract, meaning we haven't yet had the experience of it. But the Buddha's teaching that here's the abstract. Now, this is how you develop the practical experience of it. So on our cushions, we deepen our level of equanimity so that we can take it off our cushions and incorporate that into the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. It can't be done without that eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, but it also can't be carried out in our moment-by-moment life without the framework of the Eightfold Path, without the three trainings. That's what this is about. And maybe that's the most significant point here. It's not just meditation, and it's not just scriptural study, is it? It's actual practice. And where's the actual practice? The actual practice is in those middle factors of the Eightfold Path, in the virtuous aspects. That's where the rubber hits the road, isn't it? That's what the Buddha's teaching here. That's what we teach here. We incorporate right view and right intention, resting in right meditation and right mindfulness. And right effort defines us as maintaining virtue, as an expression of these other factors. Is that clear? I think I might have just made it more complicated than it needed to be. Now, we're going to get into that a little bit more. Greed and aversion disappear. This is a development of concentration that brings peace and calm here and now. It's the only time that peace and calm matter, here and now. Peace and calm doesn't matter yesterday, and it doesn't matter tomorrow. The training in heightened wisdom brings the ending of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Through the ending of these defilements, the wise Dhamma practitioner remains in the defilement release from ignorance. Ultimate goal. The wise Dhamma practitioner has established profound wisdom, fully mindful moment by moment as life occurs. He's simply defining an awakened human being, or the ultimate development of Dhamma practice. This is called heightened wisdom. These are the three trainings of my Dhamma. The trainings in heightened virtue, concentration, and wisdom establish persistence, steadfastness, absorption in jhana, renewed mindfulness, and wise restraint. These three trainings should be practiced consistently and in all situations with unlimited concentration. That, again, is such an important line, it's often overlooked. In all situations means even in situations where we don't want to, especially when we find situations where we think, where we'd rather hold on to what we think might be virtuous or compassionate views, even though they're not rooted in the Eightfold Path. They're not rooted in concentration and the virtuous factors. And this is really getting to the very subtle aspects of the Dhamma, isn't it? Again, this is where we practice seclusion, where we practice restraint, where we practice our knowledge of who and what we are in relation to the world around us. So those situations where we say, or we might not even notice that, I don't want to bring the Dhamma into this because I have a view that I'd rather hold on to, that's where we need to practice the Dhamma. In fact, most importantly, one of the reasons why I say that, it is the reason why I say that, there's this, I don't know if I even call it a movement, but engaged Buddhism has become a very popular catchphrase. And it has to do with people that consider themselves Buddhist practitioners but are protesting against something, which usually is something we should be mindful of. It usually revolves around the environment or injustice. But there's so much misguided anger and hatred that it's not Buddhist practice, and it's not going to lead to anything good. And an extreme example of that is there's even Buddhist countries now where the Buddhists are killing the Muslims, and they feel justified in doing it because the Muslims might hurt them. Or I don't know what it is, but it has no bearing in anything the Buddha taught. The Buddha wasn't a pacifist, by the way. I'm not saying that we should be pacifists. But if our motivations are still rooted in ignorance, they're going to look like that, rather than a peaceful and calm sage who understands what's occurring in the world and takes appropriate action. You know, again, I'm not talking. The Buddha wasn't someone who was secluded from the world in a physical way. He was always guiding the leaders of his time. And even in times of war, he didn't say, no, you can't ever hurt anybody, because he knew that was unrealistic. What he did was he counseled people that he knew were going into war, that once they won, to treat people with honor and dignity. There's so much incredible wisdom in that, because he knew that the other thing wouldn't work. He knew it was foolish. It would even be idle chatter to say something that someone can't possibly fulfill. But what he did do was he taught the Dhamma to ruthless people who then became less ruthless in what they did when they conquered people, because it was a natural consequence. That's a much more profound and useful teaching.
He also broke the cycle of violence.
He did, in so doing.
You know, as you're oppressing the conquered population, you're just setting up more resistance, and sooner or later, they're going to rise up and there'll be more violence, and that will have its own reaction.
Yep.
And it just goes on.
Yeah, again,
there's a lot of paradox and all that.
Well, there is, except the Buddha understood the results of ignorance.
Because one of the paradox would be, well, I don't want to, I know what you're saying, but you see what I'm saying with the paradox would be, the old paradox of, would you go back and kill a ruthless killer before that killer would kill anybody else?
How would you do that?
Well,
you're making a good point.
I don't know.
What you're dealing is in a speculation. You know, it's not a situation that's rooted in reality.
Isn't the presumption of saying this leader is killing, and to teach a Dhamma for this killer not to kill, speculative as well?
No, you bring up a good point. The Four Noble Truths are noble truths. They
right.
exist in the world. The to take a position against anything that's rooted in ignorance is rooted in ignorance. These things are going to happen in the world. And the Buddhist teachings have been around for 2,600 years, and we're just as violent as we ever been. We're never going to get to the point where we can legislate against anything that is aberrant in people's behavior, because it's rooted in ignorance.
Wasn't this the Buddha's big, when he became enlightened, wasn't that part of the reason why he was struggling as to whether or not this can be taught?
Yeah.
What you just described?
How can I... The Buddha, upon his awakening, he spent, you know, this is the exact amount of time nobody really knows, but about 2 weeks, just simply considering, is there a way to teach this? Knowing what I know about the nature of human ignorance, how can I pierce that veil of ignorance? And the thought, you know, there's also a mystical teaching about it, but the thought came to him that even if there's only a few people with the phrase is just a speck of dust in their eyes, meaning they're very close to understanding. Even if there's just a few people with just a speck of dust in their eyes, then it's worth teaching this Dhamma, because those are the ones that I'll reach. Which also shows that he wasn't setting out to be a savior or to teach another salvific religion. He knew that that was impossible. To think that we can resolve ignorance through any other way except the Eightfold Path is rooted in ignorance. And so it's foolish to even try to do that, because that just creates additional stress in the world. In other words, telling a leader who's about to go into battle, and again, we have to understand that when people went into battle, they seem to have a good reason for it, whatever it might have been. Whether it was greed or to protect their own citizens, whatever it might be. The issues are way too complicated and rooted in ignorance to say you can't do that or you shouldn't do it. It's gonna happen. How do we deal with it? How do we deal realistically with what's going to occur in this world rooted in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking? We incorporate the Dhamma as best we can. And so as an individual, I may then, and the truth of this is, off the beaten. King Ashoka, who was one of the most bloodthirsty leaders the world has ever seen, much bloodier than Hitler or Pol Pot, or, you know, pick one. He had conquered most of northern India. And there was that phrase that you put your head on a pike. There were heads on pikes, heads stuck on these poles all over northern India, So the King Ashoka could put fear in other people's minds and hearts about how powerful he was. Well, he came, this is about 250, 300 years after the Buddha's teaching. He came across the Buddha's Dhamma, integrated it, awakened, and he never harmed another soul. So it wasn't by realizing that he was immoral and a bad person, he understood the nature of his own ignorance. So much so that he never harmed another soul. And 2,300 years ago, he did something we still can't figure out today. He incorporated universal health care for everyone that was under his kingdom. And he went even a step further. He started universal veterinary care for free. From the most bloodthirsty human being to someone that gentle and compassionate through the Dhamma. Not through legislation, not from people beating him up or telling him he's wrong. He developed the Dhamma. Let me get back to this.
It comes from within, that's why.
And if it doesn't come from within and from a mind rooted in wisdom, it's always going to lead to struggle and strife.
And the goal isn't necessarily that everyone that was in his kingdom was going to do the same thing, because obviously, you know, it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. Well, and according to the Buddha's teaching, it cannot happen to a world rooted in ignorance. It's entirely possible, but I think highly unlikely that, you know, how many billions of people are on the planet that we'd all awaken. I doubt it, and the Buddha doubted it too, because there's only a very few people with just that speck of dust in their eyes. I consider myself one of those, and that's one of the reasons why I consider myself incredibly fortunate, because for some reason, and I don't know what that reason is, I was able to understand what this guy taught 2,600 years later. And we are too. I mean, it's not that it doesn't take a special kind of mind. I don't think it takes a special kind of anything, except here we are on a Saturday morning learning this most profound teaching. That's the end of all strife. It's really remarkable. And it doesn't exclude anyone, but it doesn't forcibly include anyone either. Developing these three trainings, you will be called rightly self-awakened, one who has completed the path. So if we are, again, this is such a useful sutta if we lose our way a little bit. What is the Buddha trying to teach us? It's just this. It's these three trainings. Developing these three trainings, you will be called a rightly self-awakened one who has completed the path. The cessation of ignorance of Four Noble Truths and craving for self-satisfaction extinguishes the fires of passion. Remarkable sutta, isn't it? It's three trainings. Let's start with the folks online and with Mary first. Wait a minute. I can't see what
good
I'm
morning,
doing. Good morning, Mary. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I hope everybody's doing well. It's a beautiful fall day.
Sure is.
This is a beautiful sutta. It's very simple. You know, it seems like all the teachings are here,
yeah.
But it's a very practical, breaking it down into three parts to emphasize the things that are most important. It reminds us that it's an inside job.
Yep.
Even as you were speaking, I was thinking that when we ask questions situationally, we can get caught up in the question and the situation, when what we need to do is come back to our breath and deepen our concentration. So there's, I don't know, these are my words, but a more natural flow of the, a more natural flow of the understanding. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say, that
yes,
there's a integration of the understanding, a diminishing of the ignorance. And I know what to do in this situation now because I have clarity, I have right view, and therefore I don't need to ask the question that I might have asked at the beginning of my path. The other thing that came to me, and something that David said once when we were discussing our practice, is that, you know, you were saying this is a lovely little sutta, you know, for when you I don't know exactly how you said it, but when you fall, you didn't say fall off the path, but maybe it was struggle on the path, whatever.
Yeah.
But it is the path, right? So you don't fall off the path. It's not like it's a railroad and you fall off it, you know? It is the path that being off or struggling or losing your way is the path. You're still going forward as long as you continue to come back to the practice and the breath.
Yes.
And that's very, you know, my word, very forgiving and very gentle on yourself, you know, on this journey. So thank you very much for this sutta, John.
Thank you, Mary. I'm glad you joined us. Yeah, the Dhamma is just like that, isn't it? We can get distracted, but we just come right back to it. You know, there's no hierarchical push to keep us from not falling off the path, but the path is always there. You brought up another important point. Most people in the world are against violence, or, you know, pick one, sexual predation. But we understand that the problem isn't violence or sexual predation. The problem is ignorance. And so it doesn't mean that we accept it, but we understand the underlying cause. And when we understand the underlying cause, we can actually do something about it. Again, it's not to say that we're going to change it, but within our own minds and within our own sphere of influence, we can change things like that. We can see things clearly. We don't have to lose our minds over the current focus of hatred, whatever it might be, or aversion, because we understand where it comes from. We don't lose our minds over what is occurring rooted in ignorance. Kevin, how are you? Oh, wait, let me unmute your, there it is. I think you can speak. Kevin?
Speak.
There you go.
Can you hear me?
Speak.
Good morning, nice to be here. A couple of things that, you know, I think from this sutta, one, and kind of a theme within the Sangha, I think we're getting a little caught up on words sometimes, and in this case it was seclusion. And, you know, to go on what our friend Matt said last class about the context of this, and that seclusion for these monks was pretty clear. You know, they weren't really interacting with the world in their practice, and I think we can take insight from that into our practices as householders, and seclusion means our practice, and that's you know, where the wisdom of restraint developed in our practice.
Yep.
And it's cultivated through jhana meditation. So you know, that's pretty clear, and I think that leading into that, the word restraint, we've been getting tied up on that, and I think it's important to clarify that, you know, it takes restraint to understand where anatta craves and clings, and it takes restraint to really not attach to the world and to maintain a concentrated mind. So it's almost as if, you know, our seclusion informs our restraint, or helps us cultivate the wisdom of restraint, which informs our mind state, which the Buddha, as we said, what's a calm mind? That's the awakened state, or a mind free of attaching to things. So that's kind of what I was getting out of it, and probably have more to add at a Thursday night sometime on this. But I appreciate the talk this morning, and thank you.
Good. Thank you, Kevin. Great insight. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning. I'll sit in Herbal Silence, but thank you very much for the talk.
Glad you're here. Good morning, Tim. Good
morning. I think I'll sit in Herbal Silence as well.
Glad you're here. Morning, Rob.
Good morning. Yeah, another quick run through of the path. And it shows again how repetition is so important.
Yeah.
Every time we take a stroll down the path, we find more details and better ways to apply the path. More things to contemplate over time.
Yeah. Thank you. Good morning, Jen.
Hi. Yeah, I have found that teachings and suttas that detail the four jhanas, I find myself like bumping into myself a lot when I hear these teachings, because, and I think it's, well, I know that it is grasping for understanding. Many of the teachings come very easily to me. This is the four levels of jhana is just not one that enters easily. So it's a lot more like what Ron said, kind of, I need to really tease the stuff apart and study it more, which is something that I'm averse to. It's not coming easily. And all of that has the experience of this class has been completely just me observing my own reaction to it because of the practice that has given me the ability to like be objective to my own, you know, resistances, which has been great. So, and then hearing what other people said kind of helped me sort of solidify that even more. And I just need to like sit down with some of these and just get into them a little more, and then it'll be fun.
It will.
So I just want to share that with everybody in case anyone else is experiencing anything like that before.
I think we all are. May I ask you a direct question?
Yes.
When you have 30 kids throwing spitballs, do you notice that your mind is a lot more calm now?
It's funny that you mention that because I definitely, that came into my head as I was in this class today, as I was seeing my frustration with not understanding. I was reminded of my frustration with students, especially this time of year, September. They are just insane. Freshmen trying to like figure out high school. The dukkha occurs, you know? It's just the nature of the beast. They are so angsty and energized, and that just naturally, you know, any human in that situation is just going to naturally experience, you know, some frustration. And it's been way easier to navigate it and to just, you know, let it go and not get attached to it and not feel like there's something I need to do or something I need to change or somehow, you know, whatever. It's just been, oh, this is just what's happening, and, you know, just stay on the path and practice restraint and get secluded whenever you can, and you'll know what to do. And that's it.
So the reason why I asked the question is you're describing a mind resting in equanimity.
Right. So, okay, thank you for clearing that up. Now I get them all.
Good to go.
I guess feeling resting in equanimity, that sentence sounds a lot more
restful.
Restful. Yeah. And but the there's sensation of 30 spitballs.
But there's an internal assurance that was there.
I get it.
That's the point. You are out in the world with 30 kids throwing spitballs, and yet your mind, while noticing what was occurring, was still calm and at peace. You're able. This is what it means to be. And you were present for those children in a way you never were before, because you weren't distracted by wanting them to be different in the moment. That's how it works. It's a practice. And you also brought something up. You were thinking of the same thing I was thinking.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've developed the ability to read minds. But I'm being silly to make the point. This is why the Buddha was often thought that the Buddha could read minds, But it was simply because he's mindfully present. I know Jen, we've had a lot of interactions. I know she's a teacher. And so it's just natural to think kind of the same thoughts. That's all. That's all it is.
Yeah.
It's just being mindfully present. And I can read mine, so be careful. No, I can't. Good morning, David.
Good morning, John. Thank you for your teaching.
I'm glad you're here. Becky, good to see you again. How have you been?
I've been very good, thank you. Good. I've been missing being here. I've listened online. I mean, I've listened to the recordings.
It's great.
But being here is always redirective. It redirects you, it redirects me back to the path. And I learned from this sutta, I realized from this sutta that the ways of taking the refined mindfulness that I'm trying to develop on my cushion, ways of taking that into the world, and a way of sort of keeping your mind focused and concentrated, really, as you go through your day. And very often, I'm recognizing now as I go through my day that I'm either doing that, or it's almost like bringing my breath back to my breathing when I'm on my cushion.
Yeah.
I will go through my day and something will happen and I'll be like, whoa, I'm not even anywhere near restraint and refined mindfulness right now. I have to move back. I have to move back. It seems like that's happening throughout the day. I have to. So that's where I'm at in my practice. Bringing this and coming here really started to make me see that clearer today, because I haven't been for a while. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for being here and what you said. The you're describing the development of wise restraint.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it doesn't mean that as we're developing the Dhamma, we don't get caught up in the world. We recognize that we're caught up in the world. We come back to the breath. We come back to reality. And that's Dhamma practice. Anybody can do it. It's not that hard, you know, if we really want to. The Buddha told his cousin. Cousin asked him one day, "What's the most important part of the Dhamma?" And he's expecting this grand answer. And the Buddha said, "The most important part of Dhamma practice is the Sangha." And what he's saying is we need that third refuge if we're going to develop the Dhamma. You can't do without it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can. And it's because there's nothing magical about a group of people getting together. It's because of the support we all give each other. Again, you've heard me say this so often. It is so remarkable to me what has developed here in Frenchtown. And again, I'll take a little bit of credit, but it's not me. It's all of you that come and contribute and develop the Dhamma wholeheartedly, that have made this something really, I think, unique.
Sometimes
in the world.
We're going to screaming.
Yeah, but so what?
Yeah, but it's still, yeah. And we share that kicking and screaming.
Ananda was like that at times, kicking and screaming. I was referring to Buddha's cousin. He must have had a lot of resistance to it, but yet he stayed with it every day of his life, and eventually he got there. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Morning, Julie. Good to see you.
I really enjoyed this sutta. Very enjoyed it. I'd like to add with the Sangha that I think that coming together is important, because when you meditate together, and it must like multiply by like duplicate, you know?
Yeah.
So you have 10 of us here, that's 10 times 10. And that's what the peace that you generate. You generate it within, but you generate it without, and you share it together. So it's more profound. You know, because
yes.
I think when I come to meditate in Sangha, then it's very, very profound. I can really feel it. And so that's one of the good, the benefits of coming together. And of course, sharing the knowledge is very important also. It helps us all.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I've been meditating a long time, and I meditate twice a day every day. Mm-hmm. But I look forward to coming here and meditating. You know, it's not even that it's special. It's just what it is, you know. It's just a pleasant thing to do. So, you know, I like I said, I'd be crazy if I sat here all by myself doing this. I wouldn't be doing it very long. So
thank you.
Good morning, Michael. Good to see you.
Good morning, Tom. Good to see you also. I have a lot of things going through my head here, but I'm going to try to focus, okay? So maybe, hopefully, add some clarity. Okay?
Hope so.
We'll try. If it's not me, right, then it's not you, right? If I don't own it, nor do you, right?
If you don't...
If I don't own it,
nor
do you. If it's not who I am, it's not who you are. So, and we know that once we make it about us, or... that's basically ignorance, okay? It's, so when we come in contact with a situation, individuals that, you know, are acting in a manner which could cause us to react, right?
Mm-hmm.
It helps us to understand that, again, if it's not me, if it's not, if it's not mine, and if it's not who I am, then it's the same in relation to the other person. It is not who they are. It's they don't own, and it doesn't define them. So to speak, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the actions that are perpetuated, or well, I shouldn't say perpetuated at this point. Whatever occurs in that, like that. That exchange, okay? If we're able to understand that concept of it's not being who we are, then we could also apply that to a person that is acting in a manner which we might say to be somewhat aggressive.
Uh-huh.
And this is where restraint comes in. So we don't act out. We restrain ourselves by recognizing in another individual that they're ignorant of the Four Noble Truths. They're in a different place.
Mm-hmm.
So if we, again, like us reacting to ignorance just creates our own ignorance.
So would you say that again?
When we react to the ignorance of others, it creates ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
In ourselves.
Yeah.
So restraint comes in at that point. From there, we choose what right action is as we appeal to the Eightfold Path.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
At that very profound understanding, at that point of contact, it's just what we've been talking about. You see it there. When we really understand the nature of our own ignorance, and remember, when you first started talking, I was thinking, wait a minute, you're too focused on others, but you really aren't. You brought it back to yourself. It's not the ignorance of others that we need to be concerned about. This is what you described. It's our own ignorance, because when we resolve that ignorance in ourselves, then we can understand, no matter how awful somebody's acting, that we don't need to take that personally, because they're not acting in a personal way. They're acting in a very mindless way, rooted in ignorance of the way things are. And so I can understand where people's greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking comes from, because I experienced it myself. And I also know the way out of it. So now when I hear about some of the atrocities that happen in the world, I can feel great sadness for the... I'll go back to the Las Vegas shooter. That's a pretty good example, because of the devastation that this one person, I felt like any human being, I felt incredible sadness for the people that got hurt and their families and all the other things. But at the same time, my mind doesn't go, we need to string this guy up, and while he's strung up, boil him in water or and pull his finger. Compassion for that man, for what, and he was, he's a human being too. And I can feel compassion for someone like that, even though his behavior is terribly egregious. When we develop the Dhamma, we learn to see the difference between approval and acceptance. I don't have to approve of all the horrible things that go on in the world, but I accept them because I understand where they come from. And I accept them because as long as I'm living in the world, those things are going to occur. So you take that to the, another level where we're going to now, where even if people, if situations happen in the world that upset certain individuals, we need to chase after those individuals and resolve that issue in them. Well, that's just compounding ignorance, isn't it? Rather than teaching people, it's never going to happen. Maybe I shouldn't say never, that these things occur as a consequence of having a human life. Life isn't fair. It's not meant to be fair. When we try to make life be fair, we're in trouble because it isn't. Things happen arbitrarily. And other people whose minds are rooted in ignorance will often act in ways that are rooted in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Why? Because they can't help it. And I should have compassion. Just like, you know, to me, that's a, it's a, to me, living a life rooted in ignorance is a form of mental illness. It's not as overt as other forms, but it is, isn't it?
Yes.
And it leads us to act in ways.
There's no sharp line between.
There isn't. I've never in my life have I went out and done something specifically to hurt someone, made a plan, I'm going to get that person. But I have. And it's not any more right that I have. The consequences are different, aren't they? But I never intended to hurt anybody, but yet I did. How is that possible? Think about what I'm saying. I never intended to hurt people, but I did. That means I'm out of control, isn't it? I didn't realize it. In fact, when I would do things that were hurtful towards others, whether it was in my family or maybe just out in the world, I was devastated internally. What's wrong with me? How could I be like this? How could I yell at my mother? But I didn't understand why. And so that just reaffirmed my own ignorance and my own self-loathing. Of course, nobody taught me why I was acting that way. But once I understood it, and I could take true ownership of something because I understood where it came from, then I could change it. And I can tell you, honestly, in a long, long time, I've never done anything to overtly or covertly hurt another human being or anything. And that's only, it's not because I decided I'm going to be the world's most perfect human being. I was, at one time, the world's most perfect human being, except I was still hurting people. Now I don't have to be perfect, and I don't hurt people. I don't have to be worried about it. I said a few times in here, one of the power of the Eightfold Path is once it's integrated into our lives, we no longer have to second guess ourselves or have that watching ourselves so closely. Mm-hmm. Because we know we are going to remain harmless. We know it. That there's such incredible power in that.
That's why it's the path of ease.
Yes, and we also gain the ability to talk plainly with people because we know our own intention is to be helpful. I mean, sometimes I'm talking with people, and my directness causes some upset, but it's unintended, and sometimes that type of mental upset is good. It gets us thinking. So, a remarkable class. We can see how all of this is resolving within the self, in anatta. This sutta, like all the other ones, speaks directly to that. Where did the three trainings occur? Not out there. Not in class. Not in an abstract way. The three trainings are developed within myself. And in that way, I become liberated. The three trainings for liberation. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Mary, for joining us. We'll finish, as we always do, with the Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditation posture. And gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. See.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.